Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, November 19, 2018. Jonglei State Police arrest chiefs in Bor Town.
Chiefs are the ones that are in charge of the civil population. And if the civil population under a certain chief misbehave, that means the chief must answer. He also knows where these culprits are.
And girls use sports to promote peace in South Sudan.
I feel very happy because
we were first defeated, but at the end we made it. And I want to tell my sister that there is nothing a boy can do and a girl cannot do.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. But we first go to Melbourne, Australia, where an Australian newspaper, The Age, reports that an Australian federal police agent, Graham White, wants to keep a restraining order on a suburban Melbourne house and cars owned by the family of South Sudan's Minister of Labour, General James Hort Mai. General Mai has applied for the court to dismiss the restraining order. Police allege the family's wealth was gained by corruption and money laundering. The Age reports that AFP succeeded in getting a court order to freeze assets associated with General Mai's adult son who lived in Melbourne. The case made headlines earlier this year when it emerged that AFP's interest in General Mai's family assets was sparked by a 2016 investigation by the Washington-based Enough Project. Agent White's affidavit claims the Melbourne asset accumulated by General Mai's family were likely purchased with the proceeds of corruption when he was the chief of staff of the Sudan People's Liberation Army between 2009 to 2014. The Age reports that General Mai's wife and two adult children have not declared any income since 2009, but records have shown they have received more than $500,000 Australian dollar in welfare benefits since 2006. They also lived in Australian government-funded housing for years until they purchased the house for $1.5 million Australian dollar in 2014. The Age reports General Mai's son was 22 years old and unemployed when he bought the house. Immigration records show the general visited Australia when the sale contract was signed in June 2014. The Age says Australia's Financial Criminal Intelligence Agency identified five transactions from African companies into local bank account of an Australian firm that General Mai's son controls. The largest was $621,000. Eight local chiefs have been arrested in connection with last week's killing of police officers by young men in Bor. The police commissioner of Jonglei State says the chiefs were arrested for allegedly issuing threats and inciting young men to fight the police. Deng Ai Deng reports for VOA from Bor.
Major General Jonget, the Jonglei State Police Commissioner, says the eight local chiefs are in custody in Bor Town.
We arrest them for so many, for the responsibility of to hand up the missing accused. The other, the threat that they gave on that day, that the victim is not going to be buried unless the accused brought. So that threat is a part of their charges.
Jonget says police also arrested four young men suspected of being part of the group that exchanged gunfire with the police last week.
Dead people were more than 10. It means they were 14, 15, around that. So seven names are already got, remaining seven or eight others, and in which now we are on search of them at this moment.
Jonglei State Governor Pili Vagwir says he supports the decision to arrest the chief. He says state authorities expect further investigation to determine the fate of the suspects.
The chief are the ones that are in charge of the civil population. And if the civil population under a certain chief misbehave, that means the chief must answer. He also knows where these culprits are. So the arrest of the chief is in the search of the culprits. If they produce the culprits, the chief will be released.
Aguirre says the State Capital Board is witnessing an increase in armed criminal activity. He says a combined force has been formed to take over patrolling the town from the police.
An operational force has element of police, element of prison, element of wildlife, element of the army. We may increase the element of the army because the police is unarmed, is a small in number. So the number of the army will increase and the command will be given to the army because the army will have more force.
Clansmen from the areas of the arrested chiefs are criticizing the police for arresting those they call innocent community leaders. 30-year-old Makwal Abram says police have powers to arrest any suspected criminals. He says the chiefs were not among the young men who attacked the police.
Police has no right to arrest anyone who is not on the list. So what I know from there, when the police send out, they cannot be just arresting people anyhow.
Riankur is a relative of one of the arrested chiefs. He says police should not resort to arresting chiefs when they fail to pursue criminals.
Those policemen, they are right to search for them and even to arrest them, because in order to control the situation, they can cooperate in the way that those chiefs, they can tell these people, they are the people who are suspect. So the police should arrest the suspect.
Jonglei State officials say conflict between armed young men and the police started a week ago when a police force went to arrest two suspects for failing to pay a fine of 6 cows in Bor County Court for breaking a man's arm. The suspects resisted, and about a dozen armed young men exchanged gunfire with police, killing 3 police officers and wounding several others. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng.
A senior church leader is calling on South Sudanese to welcome foreigners in the country. Bishop Santo Lako Pio, auxiliary bishop of the Catholic Archdiocese of Juba, says the recent killing of a Kenyan Jesuit priest in Gok State has tarnished the image of South Sudan. Onen Walter Solomon reports for VOA from Juba.
Bishop Lako condemned the killing of Father Victor Odhiambo, a Jesuit missionary who was training teachers in Chibet, Gok State.
He was just killed in cold blood by the usual people called unknown gunmen. It is a painful situation that we are in an era of peace, and then the people who are coming to help us are getting killed. This is a bad signal. So whoever is going around killing people, we are appealing to you that you are not doing a good thing. So we pray for the family of Victor, for his congregation of the Jesuits, and we pray for the Diocese of Rumbe, who are in great shock.
Father Victor Olioko Odhiambo, who was the principal of Majulare Teachers College, was shot and killed by unknown men at the Daniel Comboni Jesuit compound Wednesday night. Bishop Lako, speaking during his Sunday homily at the St. Teresa Cathedral in the Juba suburb of Katoro, says he believes Father Odhiambo's killer has harmed South Sudan's image.
It's not correct, and he should not do that, especially at this moment, tarnishing the image of the whole country, tarnishing the image of a people who are peaceful. One single sinner making sin multiply. Can you see this? It looks simple, but then it is complicated. Let us pray today that God may give us this spirit of rejuvenating our lives, making our lives new,
making our lives of people who want to be peaceful in a peaceful environment, enjoying what God has given to us, that the difficulties we have gone through should not make us remain arrogant, distrusting one another.
Lako says South Sudanese should welcome and accept people of all races and tribes, irrespective of their origin,
so that we are able to be a community that can embrace even missionaries. People who are not originally from South Sudan will live anywhere in peace and they will not be feeling threatened. Now, Father Odhiambo is a Kenyan. He's a Jesuit. What do you think you people have created, we have created through that single act? A confusion. We pray that our missionaries will be respected. Not only our missionaries, all of us.
This is the second killing of a Kenyan clergy member in South Sudan. The Gok state government has declared 3 days of mourning for Odhiambo. State Information Minister John Madol told local media that the motive for the killing was not clear, but says 3 suspects who were arrested have confessed to the killing. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
A British journalist, Peter Martel, has covered South Sudan for the last decade for BBC and the French press agency. Martel has written a new book called First Raise a Flag, How South Sudan Won the Longest War but Lost the Peace. He describes how what was then Southern Sudan was left behind when Sudan declared independence from the British in 1956. He also describes a special medal that was supposed to be created for South Sudan's freedom fighters in 2011.
In the run-up to independence in 2011, I was showing the plans and heard about the discussion of what was to be the idea of a medal for freedom, for the heroes who fought for South Sudan's independence. And the medal, the design was to have the date from 1820 to 2011, so there's 191 years. And so I wanted to study and look at this long history that for foreigners is so often ignored and forgotten, because we coming to South Sudan from outside often only come for 2 or 3 years perhaps, and we forget about the very, very long struggle that's known so well to South Sudanese themselves, but for outsiders we think this has been a battle for the last few years and not something that's been going on for literally centuries.
Why is this area of which used to be part of Sudan such a battleground for control from other countries? First the Egyptians, then the British, and then they were being neglected by the Sudanese government in Khartoum. Why is that?
I mean, I think South Sudan is a place that's been, it has rich resources, and it's been a place that for a long period of time, it was left alone by the outside world, if you want. But the people inside South Sudan created their own systems of governance. But it meant that when the world, when sort of outside forces saw these resources and wanted them for themselves, whether that was slave raiders coming over 200 or so years ago, or the British colonialists, and then a progressive series over the years of different outside forces wanting, the resources of South Sudan and creating and fueling and encouraging the wars that have so blighted, what could be such a wonderful land.
And that goes to the point that for generations, these people have never known sustained peace.
Indeed, yes. When you look at the long history, all the land that would become South Sudan in 2011 is, one of conflict and war and suffering. But on the other hand, even today, I know as a journalist covering the most recent conflicts of South Sudan, you can have violence in one area and yet not so far away have an area that appears to be peaceful and stable. So although this long history of conflict is there, it's something that I wanted to reflect in the book, because at the same time, people are getting on with their normal lives. They're living, they're growing up, they're bringing up children, enjoying life at the same time. So in the midst of this suffering and struggle and conflict, there's still, you know, the wonderful life of day-to-day South Sudan that still goes on, and an incredible resilience of the people despite, you know, everything that's sometimes thrown at them.
That's Peter Mattel, author of the new book, Raise the Flag, How South Sudan Won the Longest War but Lost the Peace. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme from Nairobi. Tomorrow, in part two of this interview, Mattel talks about how many outsiders fail to realize there is a lot more to know about South Sudan. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at a protest in Cameroon.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who gives you the best advice?
My mom. She gives me the best advice because I could see that from childhood to now, whatever she had advised me to do has made me a successful person.
My best friend, most of the times. Yeah, my best friend. Because I think she's the one I'm more open to. I tell her most of my things going on in my life.
Yeah, my mom. I always miss seeing my mom because she's always closer to me. And anytime she sees anything about me, even I don't tell her, she knows. She feels emotional for me, and I think she's the best person who can give me an advice.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Disabled people in Cameroon are protesting the deepening crisis in the country's restive English-speaking region after clashes between government forces and armed separatists killed several handicapped people. A number of people caught up in the fighting have been made disabled as well. Their protest in towns across Cameroon Monday comes after a bloody weekend in which at least 25 armed men and several troops were killed. Muki Edwin
54-year-old Martin Dende was among tens of disabled Cameroonians protesting near the Ministry of Defense Monday against the killing of handicapped people. Dende, who has a hearing impairment for 35 years, went to teach philosophy in the English-speaking northwestern town of Kom in September 2017. He was there for barely a month when armed separatists attacked and torched his school for refusing to close its doors. Ndende says he and several teachers were abducted and tied to a tree. It was a week before Cameroon's military came to the rescue, too late to save his broken right hand, which had to be amputated. Ndende says he is an unfortunate victim of the offensive things armed gangs do to people in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. He simply went to educate children in the restive areas, he says, because true patriots and loving parents would never accept to compromise the education of their children. Even in war-torn countries, children are protected and allowed their right to education, says Ndende. Christopher Ayombe is leader of Cameroon's Coalition of People Living with Disabilities. He organized the protest in towns in the restive regions and Yaoundé to urge both the military and separatists to stop killing civilians, especially the handicapped.
We are going to educate the military services how to engage persons with disabilities in crisis time. We have persons with disabilities who do not hear, and they were shot down based on the fact that they gave instructions and they did not hear. So in such situations, how do you identify someone who do not hear? How do you identify somebody who cannot see?
Cameroon's military says over the weekend, it killed 20 terrorists in Kom, including a separatist general known as Amigo. Ayombe says a blind civilian was killed during the clashes in Kom because nobody helped him escape the shooting. At least 12 disabled people have disappeared during the two-year conflict and are feared dead, says Ayombe. Spokesman for Cameroon's military, Colonel Didier Bajek, says troops do their best to avoid civilian casualties.
Le ministre délégué à la présidence chargé de la défense, à chaque étape et chaque fois que l'occasion s'est présentée...
He says Cameroon's defense minister always reminds his military on the need to remain professional, even in difficult moments, and does not hesitate to punish any soldier found to have abused the rights of citizens. While the military respects the rights of all citizens, says Bajek, armed terrorists who often take drugs attack and kill civilians. Bajek did not give specific examples of troops punished for abuses. Cameroon's military says more than 1,200 people have been killed in the past year of fighting between security and separatists, while hundreds have been abducted. Last week, armed men abducted 16 Roman Catholic nuns in the northwestern town of Kumbu. They were set free and unharmed a day later. Earlier this month, suspected separatists kidnapped 79 students and 3 staff from a school in the northwest. All were released within days. Rights groups accuse both the Cameroon military and separatists fighting for the independent English-speaking state of using excessive force. Nearly 250,000 more people have fled the ongoing violence. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
It's World Toilet Day, and despite the world moving leaps and bounds in areas like technology and medicine, there are still some countries where basic access to clean and proper sanitation is denied to millions. In South Africa, there are still thousands of people using pit latrines, most of them children. From Johannesburg, Yasra Rampashda has the story.
Nearly 25 years into South Africa's democracy, more than 4,000 schools still use pit latrines. The Department of Basic Education says the legacy of apartheid and a lack of finances are to blame for the slow pace of building proper flush toilets at all schools. The problem affects the poorest of the poor, leaving children to use unsafe and unsanitary pit toilets when they should be focused on using their education to improve their lives. One businessman, Vasi Naidu, has been working in some rural schools fitting a product called Toilet Smart in efforts to help children have access to better sanitation. Toilet Smart is a powder that is poured into the latrines.
You know, it's a list of bacteria that kills and eats the sewage. And another thing, it's also an environmental friendly product, and also for health reasons. It doesn't spread cholera and all the waterborne sewage diseases.
Naidu said the project started because pit latrines pose major health risks to the people using it. The pit toilets are particularly dangerous for children. Many fall into them and get hurt. Some even die.
That's drowning, where they fall into these pits, you know. That's where the children die. But more importantly, also the water becomes contaminated with the sewage. You get you can get all these diseases. The switch, the like I said, the waterborne diseases. You get allergia, cholera, diarrhea, all that comes up with these untreated sewage.
For those living in communities where pit toilets remain, all they can do is hope nothing tragic happens, while government, charities, and businesses move slowly toward fixing the problem. Yashira Rampasad for VOA News in Johannesburg.
A girls' soccer tournament over the weekend in South Sudan used the theme "Shoot to Score and Not to Kill" as part of the search for peace in the country. The tournament is organized by a football club group called Nashvik Initiative in collaboration with IMPs and Youngsters Local Football Association. Nasra Victoria, the founder of the Nashvik Initiative, says it also aimed at encouraging women to participate in sports. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Hundreds of people cheered as Elizabeth from the Sunrise team dribbling the ball towards goalpost of Trustlink's football team. The game ended with Sunrise beating Trustlink 2-1. Speaking in Arabic, 21-year-old Diana Alonyo, who scored the winning goal for Sunrise, says she started playing football in 2013. She says she joined boys' training on the soccer field. She encourages more girls to join male-dominated sports.
I feel
very happy because we were first defeated, but at the end we made it. And I want to tell my sister that there is nothing a boy can do and a girl cannot do. A girl can do everything, and I want to encourage you that if you want to play, come and join any team.
26-year-old Susanna Awal was on the bench as a substitute. She says soccer keeps the players busy instead of sitting idle and discussing politics that could easily cause misunderstandings. She says soccer brings people from different backgrounds together.
We play actually as to entertain those who are watching the game, you know, because some of them have already been traumatized. And for them coming to watch the young women, young men playing, you see, for them they will have hope that South Sudan in some years to come, the young leaders will be a different generation, apart from the old regime that will soon be going out.
26-year-old Nasra Victoria is a retired player with South Sudan's Gutala Football Club and founder of the Nasvik Initiative, which began promoting football among young women last year. She says the girls' soccer tournament aims to contribute to the implementation of the peace agreement because football can foster unity.
So make our girls or the players feel the extension of the peace agreement. So, of course, the entire peace agreement or the peace celebration was about peace and reconciliation. So I felt we should also extend now to our girls through this tournament and playing, because as they play in the pitch, there is no fighting. They're always aiming at scoring, okay? Yes. They're aiming at scoring a goal, not killing their opponents. So through them striving to score a goal, or that struggle of scoring a goal, they always, now they build a team. They end up building a team that focuses at scoring a goal, not harming each other.
Victoria says South Sudanese have suffered since fighting began in 2013. She says the signing of the revitalized peace agreement should open the doors for reconciliation and long-lasting peace in South Sudan.
Through this tournament, I think and I feel, as even amongst the players, that hostility is there. But if we keep them playing together and them training together as people from different tribes, from different areas or geographical locations, there's that team building. And through that team building, even these girls become friends.
Victoria hopes to form a South Sudanese women's national team so that women can take part in international sports.
My achievement is to see full support for women's sports and also breaking that cultural norms in most of our societies of looking at women's sports as a curse or as a taboo. So what I would want to see also is that a full national team, women national team, is established in South Sudan. We don't have a national team,
yeah.
And it's something so embarrassing looking at our population and the talented girls we have.
Nasvik Initiative organized its first girls tournament last year. Victoria intends to organize another tournament next November. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
That's our show for this Monday. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
يملى العريض تفيد
على خير في أرضنا لمن وديها لك يلا العريض طفيد الخير في أرضنا يبلعيس